This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the fourth week of June, and this week, I can't believe I get to say this. Ross and Liz, what week is this?
I think you want us to say
Infrastructure week?
Yes, that's
it's
right.
Infrastructure week.
There we go.
Yes, this is Left, Right, and Center. As always, I'm your center, and here I am on Infrastructure Week. I'm joined by Ross Douthat, columnist for the New York Times on the right. Welcome to Infrastructure Week, Ross.
Thank you. I've got my hard hat on, ready to go.
Good. And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Liz, do you have your shovel ready?
I'm a sexy nurse. Thank you, Josh.
I don't know what that has to do with Infrastructure Week.
Well, everything's infrastructure.
Well, but that's the thing, actually. This week, not everything is infrastructure. On Thursday, President Biden gathered with a bipartisan group of senators to announce a deal on a bipartisan infrastructure package. The package would add about $580 billion in new spending over 8 years on roads, transit, rail, water systems, electrical grid, broadband. So basically, the stuff that was in Biden's original proposal that is in the traditional definition of infrastructure. Other things that he had been looking for, like corporate tax increases, housing programs, home health care. That's not in here, although Democrats are very clear they intend to move a separate spending bill through the budget reconciliation process, which would allow them to do a bunch of those things without Republican support. Here's what the president had to say about that.
What we agreed on today is what we could agree on, the physical infrastructure. There was no agreement on the rest. We're going to have to do that through the budget process. And we need a fair tax system to pay for it all. I'm not going to rest until it all both get to my desk. And lastly, I know there are some of my party who discouraged me from seeking an agreement with our Republican colleagues, who said that we should go bigger and go alone. To them, I say this. I've already shown in my young presidency that I'm prepared to do whatever needs to get done to move the country forward. That's what I did with the American Rescue Plan, which is $1.9 trillion. Let me say this. When we can find common ground, though, working across party lines, that is what I will seek to do. The reason why is because the broader support a proposal has in Congress, the stronger its prospects for passage.
So, Liz, is this a good deal that Biden cut?
I mean, I think he's acknowledging there it could have been better. And at the same time, I'm glad to see that he is taking an approach that does have an aspect of it that will go through budget reconciliation, right? I mean, I think you're seeing in the party writ large, and we talked about this with Manchin last week, a loosening up of approaches towards, Democrat-only governance, legislating with the votes they have in the party itself. Manchin and Sinema have held this up for a while. But I hope they start taking that approach more often, especially on legislation like this, where there's really no good reason for Republicans to hold it up other than that they can. And I think it ultimately would be good for the Democrats to push through. So, I think it could have been better. I think it's good nevertheless. And I hope that the Democrats continue to move towards governing with what they've got.
Well, and what do you make of what's actually expected to be in this package? I realize, and we'll talk about the plan for the two tracks and that they're going to seek to do some sort of reconciliation bill. I think a big open question is what will actually be in it. But here we have over $100 billion for roads and bridges. We have money to upgrade the electrical grid. We have money to upgrade water systems, replace lead service pipes. Do these look like good ways for the government to be spending money, in your view?
I think so. I mean, I've been a huge advocate, especially for replacing lead surface pipes. I mean, I know that it's sort of a boring issue that doesn't sound especially sexy on the surface, but, you start looking at issues like Flint and what a major crisis that was. And there are slow boiling small crises like that all over the country constantly. And it's hard to understate the trouble that lead causes, especially for poor inner city communities all over the United States all the time. These have long reaching, extremely serious consequences, especially for low income people. So I think that's an amazing expenditure of money, and I wholeheartedly support it.
Ross, what do you make of the content of this deal that has won over quite a few Republicans in the Senate?
I mean, I guess I see it as sort of a B minus in the what do we do with free money question that has sort of become, where Congress can actually find common ground. I mean, generally, I think the claims that U.S. infrastructure is in absolutely terrible shape and deteriorating under our feet and so on tend to be a little bit overblown. I think actually probably like Liz. If I were just sort of spending money flat out, I would be spending it directly on family policy, and not maybe to the same extent on physical infrastructure. With that being said, there's always room to fix physical infrastructure in the U.S. It's a big country. You're going to have worthwhile projects. I agree with Liz about the lead abatement issues. And, you know, the argument from the populist right for some of these ideas back in the Trump presidency was that, you know, this sort of amounts in part to a sort of very mild form of industrial policy, you know, effectively a subsidy for certain kinds of blue collar work. Again, it's not an ideal way to do any of that, but it is a way to do some of that. And yeah, so B minus, I think, is where I am.
About half the new money in here is for transportation, and a little less than half of it is for non-transportation infrastructure. My view the whole way through this is that I'm way more enthusiastic about the non-transportation stuff. I think it's unclear the extent to which the pandemic has permanently changed our usage of transportation infrastructure. If you have permanently less commuting because you have more full-time workers who work from home or more workers who work from home more days, then the urgency of adding capacity to highways and transit systems becomes significantly less. I think we've seen why we need power grid upgrades, both because of the unreliability that's happened in parts of the country and because if you're trying to electrify the economy for environmental reasons, you're going to need more power transmission capacity. I share both of your enthusiasm for the water upgrade. So that's the part of this that I'm happiest about the spending. I'm a little iffy on whether we're actually going to get good value for money when we build more highways and more transit. But Liz, one of the points of contention among Democrats is whether this bill does enough on climate. And there's a lot of climate money in here, money for electric vehicle infrastructure and those power grid upgrades are important for environmental policy. What are you looking for them to add in a reconciliation bill that goes bigger than what's in here? Because you see a number of senators like Brian Schatz and Chris Murphy basically saying there needs to be more of an environmental commitment in this spending package.
You know, I think it's a really good question. I think that the climate issue is a really difficult one for the United States to answer on a number of levels. When I think about spending that would really make a dent in the climate issue, I honestly think about technological solutions. I think about direct air capture and other types of spending that would directly ameliorate carbon in the atmosphere. I know I'm sort of in a strange minority on the left there. I think a lot of folks on the left talk about green energy spending, and I believe in that as well. I think that renewable energy resources are important, and we should be spending money adapting more of our energy resources into clean energy resources. I think that's important. But I think that's sort of slow and small scale, and probably all of our solutions to climate change are at this point. But we should be spending a lot more money, I think, trying to figure out how to do things like direct air capture at scale. And that's where I would be putting, personally, if I were the Biden administration, as much money as possible.
The interesting thing about this open two-track strategy, saying we're going to have one bipartisan bill with what Republicans can agree to, and then we're going to do another bill with a bunch of stuff that Republicans hate, is, Ross, I wonder how that affects the willingness of Republicans to cooperate in this bipartisan bill. Because basically, you could say you're giving your rubber stamp to a Biden administration that is spending way more money than you think it should and giving legitimacy to this agenda that's going to go spend maybe trillions of dollars on top of this. The flip side, I guess, is this stuff is going to happen anyway, or some of it's going to happen anyway. You might as well take credit for the parts of it that you think are good. And so you can go back to your state or your district and point to all of these projects that you have helped to finance. So what do you see as the calculus for Republicans? And particularly, I find it interesting, if we get this bipartisan infrastructure package, we've seen a lot of big partisan legislation in the last couple of decades, and we've seen a number of big pieces of legislation that have really broad support on both sides of the aisle. What I can't remember since 20 years ago with the Bush tax cuts is a piece of bipartisan legislation that pulled off a rump of a party, like 10 senators, with most of them opposed to it. So it's going to be an odd position for Republicans, right? If this goes through with 12 or 15 Republican votes in the Senate, most Republicans opposing it, but Biden's out there, he can say it's bipartisan, and you get a few senators like Susan Collins and Mitt Romney who get to take Republican credit for it.
Right, and I think what the second calculus that you described is certainly what's going through the mind of the Republican senators involved in it. And I think if you're sort of doing, you know, internal Kremlinology of the Republican Senate, You would basically assume that the movers here clearly are those 10 to 12 Republican senators themselves, that, you know, everybody keeps saying, well, you know, what will Mitch McConnell say? What will Mitch McConnell do? I think the fact that you've gotten this far with this suggests that this is basically these senators sort of ask of McConnell, right? They're basically saying, look, we, you know, we're going to be with you on most things, but we want to do this. And, you know, we have a lot of power in a closely divided Senate. You know, we want you to let us do this. And then if it blows up, I think it will be the senators themselves who end up backing away, precisely because if you end up with a version of what you already had, I think somewhat strangely from Biden, this statement yesterday that, you know, he's only going to sign this bill if he's getting the other bill as well. If that becomes the narrative, right, that, like, this is literally part of a package deal, not just we're going to do this and then maybe the Democrats are going to do that, that's where I think the Republicans in this group of 10 to 12 could start backing away. So I don't think it's McConnell killing it. I think it's, you know, someone like Bill Cassidy, right, who just, yes, you know, said in response to Biden saying this, oh, I was a little taken aback by Biden saying that. It's those, the senators who are invested in it right now, who will be the decisive figures if it falls apart, I think.
Liz, what I think is interesting about that threat from Biden that, frankly, I don't find very credible when he says, you know, this big deal that I've worked on so hard that I'm announcing, I'm only going to sign it if you also do this other thing. What I think holds this process together and makes it likely that we will get to the finish line and this will pass is that while you have all these Democrats saying there must be a reconciliation bill, it has to be done as a package deal and we need both of them to pass, what that doesn't specify is what's going to be in the reconciliation bill. And so I think it's likely that they can come up to some agreement to use the budget reconciliation process to do something. But the wish list is both very long and very expensive. And in order to get this bill through, you need every Democratic vote in the Senate. You need almost every Democratic vote in the House. And so I don't think the final form of the reconciliation bill is going to look anything like the Biden administration wish list on this, on corporate tax increases, on some of that environmental spending. There's even talk about wanting to include some sort of immigration reform in that reconciliation bill. And so I guess my question is, what happens when Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema remain unwilling to do a lot of the big ticket items that Democrats are hoping to have in the reconciliation bill? And so you get a reconciliation bill, but it's not at all what Nancy Pelosi would have written if she got to write it herself. Where does that leave this deal?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that the Democrats have been struggling with since the beginning of Biden's presidency, right? When they had this very narrow, balance of power in their favor, right? They've been struggling with Manchin. They've been struggling with Sinema. And it's funny because Sinema had kind of been, you know, heretofore maybe a little bit of an icon in the party, being from this red state and having this sort of strange charisma in the eyes of some. But I think they should do more to discipline their members, right? I mean, Sinema and Manchin are holding.
What can they do?
Biden has spoken ill of them somewhat in public. Manchin and Sinema don't like that very much. It obviously bothers them because they whine about it when he does it. Trump was certainly more than happy to do that with Republicans, and they whined about it, at length. I think that Biden should do a little bit more of it. And I think it's incumbent upon the press, right? I mean, in terms of liberal commentators, they should be more than happy to take a swing at Manchin and Sinema for doing what they're doing because they're holding up Biden's agenda.
But here's what I think is the thing with that. It's that, I mean, Biden got like 30% of the vote in West Virginia. Manchin might find it personally annoying when the president complains about him, but it's only good for him politically to be showing distance from the Democratic president and emphasizing how independent he is. And I think you're right. I don't think Donald Trump would have put up with it. But what Donald Trump would have done is he would have run Joe Manchin out of the Senate, caused him to not run for re-election, or maybe lose a primary in West Virginia, or in the equivalent state that was strongly Democratic that happened to have a moderate Republican senator. And then you would have lost the seat to the other party. And so I think, you know, Trump was more focused on preventing defections on the issues he truly cared about in the Congress, but it had a real electoral penalty for the Republican Party. And I think, you know, especially in a state like West Virginia, you're not going to get anywhere by trying to push around the sort of fluky Democratic senator you have there. Now, I think I agree. It's different in Arizona, which is a purple state. You could conceivably make Sinema concerned about a primary challenge from her left. She should be more amenable to that sort of pressure. But I think the flip side of it is she does have that charisma that I know people on the left have come to find mystifying and maddening. But I think she is a talented, appealing politician. And so I think it is a little bit hard to put that pressure on her.
What do you guys think the ask is, right? Like when you get to the reconciliation bill, because it seems to me if you're trying to put pressure on either Sinema or Manchin or any other moderate Democrat in the Senate, of which there are a number who are very happy to have Manchin and Sinema taking all the heat, I don't think you can just sort of say, well, we want to put pressure on you to do this, that, this, and this, you know, these six things that are important to progressives. I think you're going to need to say, like, okay, we really want this to include an immigration component, or we really want this to include this kind of tax hike. Because otherwise you're just sort of, you know, you don't have an ask. You don't have a thing that you're trying to get.
Well, of course.
My guess is from the perspective of the Biden White House, the top priorities here are certain social spending items, especially an extension of the child allowance that was implemented for only 1 year. And I think they're concerned about tax increase pay fors for that. I think they want some of these corporate tax and maybe capital gain tax provisions in there. So I think those are the big asks. I will be shocked if there is an immigration component of a reconciliation bill. But I think even those two core areas, I think those are heavy lifts to do a lot of them, because it's so much money you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it would be this a non-phased in expanded child tax credit. That would be the thing that I know they're struggling to try to make permanent. And I know that'll be difficult.
And I think, you know, you can get there on that. The big areas of disagreement seem to be about how it should phase out. I know Senator Angus King, for example, is very exercised about the idea that you can have households with quite high incomes who have several children who, like, even though they make, you know, over $200,000 a year, they can still get the credit. That's a thing you can argue about what the ideal design is. You can design around that. I think the harder part is, do you actually think you need tax increases to fully offset what's in this? And I think it's hard to get political agreement on the content of those tax increases, especially at a time when interest rates are so low and the government really does not desperately need that revenue this year or next year. Let's leave that there. I will be back with Ross Douthat of the New York Times and Liz Brunig of the Atlantic to talk about the massive public opinion change on gay marriage. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider. On the right is Ross Douthat, columnist for the New York Times. And on the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at the Atlantic. According to the Gallup poll, just 27% of Americans supported same-sex marriage in 1996, the year when President Bill Clinton signed the Defense of Marriage Act to prevent federal recognition of such marriages and to protect states' ability to disregard any same-sex marriages blessed by other states. Less than 20 years later, same-sex marriage had majority support, and the Supreme Court threw out DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, ruling that states were constitutionally obligated to allow gay marriage. Now it has over 70% support, including 55% of Republicans, according to Gallup. So how did that happen? And what can other movements for policy and social change learn from the extremely effective movement behind the big policy and opinion shift on gay marriage? To discuss that, we're joined now by Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha is Washington correspondent for Monocle Magazine, a political reporter, and author of several books. His newest book is called The Engagement, America's Quarter-Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Josh.
So I want to note, as you describe in the book, gay marriage wasn't merely unpopular before the 1990s. It wasn't even really on the agenda. Gay rights organizations weren't necessarily sure they wanted it or that they ought to seek it. So where did this issue come from?
So I tell the story. The book starts in 1989 in Honolulu, where basically a petty rivalry within a pride planning committee spirals out of control. There's a local activist named Bill Woods who wants to launch a parade. He's participating in a planning committee that's run by these two lesbians who had launched a magazine that is now competing with his gay newspaper for advertising. They don't want anything to do with his parade. He spins off his own Pride Planning Council and in looking for ways to sort of upstage the Pride picnic that is being scheduled by the other group. He alights on the idea of having a sort of big Mooney-style mass wedding on stage at the end of the parade. And he's not a lawyer. He clearly misreads the state's marriage statute. And in trying to get the ACLU to back this, launches a PR stunt on December 17th, 1990. He leads three couples into the Hawaii Health Department. They request marriage licenses. They're rejected, but the next year, a local civil rights attorney sues on their behalf. And to the surprise of everybody involved, in May 1993, the Hawaii Supreme Court becomes the first court on earth to rule that the fundamental right to marriage could extend to same-sex couples.
And so if you start from there, from that very disorganized effort, if you can call it an effort, around an issue that polled very poorly, if you polled about it at all, how did we get from that in about 20 years to gay marriage nationally across the United States and many countries around the world with broad public support? That seems like remarkable, unusual success. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, so a big part of it is that conservatives, religious conservatives, mobilized in opposition to same-sex marriage even before the gay rights movement was united around it as an objective. And this starts with the Mormon Church, which becomes the first institution on the mainland to really appreciate the gravity of what's happening in Hawaii. And then eventually evangelical and Catholic activists take an interest in it. And that's what leads to the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996. And so at that moment, what has happened is that a very local, even parochial fight in Hawaii in that state's courts has now been elevated to a national issue and something that's in the federal code. And it begins to unite the gay rights movement around it. The big breakthrough is when the Massachusetts Supreme Court rules in favor of plaintiffs suing for the right to marriage in 2003, and same-sex couples are able to legally marry the next year in Massachusetts. And I think what that fundamentally does is just sort of shifts the rhetorical burden of the debate, where beforehand, opponents of same-sex marriage were able to make basically any claim about what would happen to, you know, the institution of the family, to Western civilization, whatever, if marriage laws changed. And it was sort of non-falsifiable up until May 17th, 2004. And after gay and lesbian couples start marrying in Massachusetts, I think it becomes very difficult for opponents to, you know, sustain, let alone grow a coalition of people who are invested in stopping this.
Ross, what do you make of that? This was such a center of social conservative politics for much of my lifetime. And the issue seems to have basically gone away. So was it when you had social conservatives warning about how this was going to set off a slippery slope and, you know, do all sorts of additional destructive things to society, did that happen? Like, why is there a reason that it's still not an exercising, agitating issue for social conservatives like it was when it was an open political fight?
Well, I mean, I think a couple things happened. One, there was not, in spite of all of the general predictions and prophecies of destruction, if you will, that social conservatives made, there wasn't a specific identifiable cost to specific identifiable parties to allowing same-sex marriages, right? So once you had a situation where, you know, gay people were out of the closet and people had gay friends and, you know, you were just in a very different cultural landscape overall than the world of 1975 or even 1990. I think it just became, you know, really, really hard to sort of counterpose a kind of amorphous cultural harm to the specific reality that, you know, your friend Larry, he's a good guy. He lives with his partner. He wants to get a marriage license. What's the big deal? So in that sense, yeah, it was unlike many other polarizing cultural issues, right, where you can, you know, if you're pro-life, any abortion is pretty obviously a direct harm to the fetus, the unborn human life. Like that's, you know, that harm is sort of tangible in the most direct and obvious way. In this case, I think the argument just sort of collapsed as a matter of public debate because the benefits were concentrated and any harm was extremely diffuse. Now, with that being said, if you had gone back in time to 2004 and described the world that we live in 2021, where, you know, not only is same-sex marriage legal, but like things like single-gender bathrooms are, you know, under pressure, you have, you know, intense controversy around transgender rights, you have a growing normalization of polyamory, all of these things. In fact, a lot of the slippery slope things that social conservatives expected did come to pass. We just sort of take them for granted, and liberals who once would have dismissed them now have sort of adopted them as good and normal features of the world. So I don't think it's that social conservatives were wrong. I think it was that they counterposed, I mean, they were wrong about some sort of the more apocalyptic predictions, but they counterposed something amorphous and broadly cultural to something, a specific benefit, and the specific benefit was always going to win in that situation.
I think what you describe is a really large social shift from, say, 1975 to now. But I don't think that there was a huge accompanying social change between, say, 2004 and 2013, a period during which you did have this enormous shift in the political landscape, where this was the 2004. I came out when I was in high school in 2000. There was a lot of awareness of gay people in everyday life in the United States, and it was still a political winning issue for Republicans to put anti-same-sex marriage questions on ballots all over the country, and the politics on that shifted. I think shifted even faster than the cultural change shifted. So am I wrong to think that there must be an additional component of why the politics changed so much?
Well, I mean, I think the speed of the change is partially goes to something that Sasha wrote about in his book and turned into a, you know, provocative, exciting New York Times op-ed that ran a couple weeks ago. Right, that this was a case where you had a sort of consolidation of elite opinion that happened a lot faster than the shift in public opinion writ large. And with that consolidation of elite opinion, you got, you know, a kind of version of cancel culture, right?
Yeah, I think Ross's take is right. My, you know, I think two things were happening on the campaign front sort of in the years between 2008 and 2012 in particular. One is the sort of effectiveness of those boycott and public shaming efforts to scare a lot of significant donors, and not just individuals, but you know, like the Archdiocese of Portland, Maine, basically stops spending money on state level ballot initiatives in their state because of this these efforts. And at the same time, you have the expansion, not just of a group of incredibly influential gay donors for whom this is the top issue on the LGBT agenda, but it becomes a cause that by 2010, 2011, a lot of non-gay progressive donors, you know, Mike Bloomberg, Jeff Bezos, you know, Brad Pitt are giving six or seven figure contributions to gay marriage campaigns in states. But you also have a number of conservative donors led by Paul Singer, the hedge fund guy, whose son came out during that period, became highly invested in not just giving money himself, but recruiting Wall Street donors. And so you do get this huge elite-driven sort of flip in the resource equation that had not been present when this had been fought out at the state or federal level in earlier years when the religious right sort of entered these conflicts with significant financial edge over gay marriage supporters.
Liz, I think it's fair to say that you hold a number of political positions that do not have majority support in the country. So when you look at this public opinion trajectory and this policy trajectory and the success that this movement had in turning around both the public and policymakers and various influential elites to a new position, do you see anything there that tells you tactics or strategy that you would like your allies to be taking into other movements trying to replicate that?
I wish. I mean, the gays have so many things that I wish that we had. for one, making gay marriage legal didn't cost anyone anything. It didn't cost them money. When you look at socialism, it costs money. They're just going to have to be pay-fors. There's no way around it. I wish there were. The modern monetary theory story where it's not going to cost anyone anything, and actually we can just kind of create a welfare state out of whole cloth and no one will even notice a difference. That's a fantasy. It's ridiculous. It's a lie. And I'm very irritated by the rise of that kind of rhetoric, because I think it's just punting on an issue we're going to have to deal with eventually. And so, you know, that's a problem that any kind of welfarist politics is going to have to deal with. And that's just fundamentally different. Ultimately, you know, with the struggle for gay rights and gay marriage, it was sexy and it was funny. And there's a sense of humor and there's a culture there. There's great film and literature and theater that came out of it. And that's a way for people who aren't gay and have no real experience with being a part of that world to feel like they were allies or had a relationship with, you know, something that they're not a part of, you know, that they could relate to that experience. There's just really not a lot of ways to take the very grim fact of, look, some people are extremely poor and they need welfare. There's really not a way to put that on the stage or kind of create a literature or a culture around that that is funny or sexy or brings people in a way that's kind of warm and relatable. I mean, there is a literature there. There is culture there that people can view if they want to. But I don't think it tends to generate a lot of warm feelings or make people feel particularly integrated. So that's just another fundamental difference. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's an interesting case study in a particular rights struggle, and a very successful one. It's just that, you know, for the welfarists among us, it's going to be a very different battle.
I agree with Liz. It's really tough to apply the same-sex marriage model to issues of taxes and spending and welfare benefits. I think, though, same-sex marriage created a sense on the left that you could win other kinds of cultural battles this way, right? That you could basically say, okay, we ruled opposition to same-sex marriage off the table through elite consensus and elite pressure, and we can do the same thing with, say, debates over immigration or, you know, debates about right now how you teach about race and racism in school. And in that sense, I think it's been tremendously influential for left-wing politics in this country, not necessarily in a good way, because in fact, even cultural battles are actually, most cultural battles are much harder to win and sort of settle and resolve than this has seemed to be over the last 20 years.
Yeah, I want to ask Sasha about that, because I thought your essay in the New York Times about the invention of cancel culture as a tool, as a tactic in the gay marriage fight that was effective, with the most prominent example, I think, being the boycott of hotelier Doug Manchester, who at the time owned a large convention hotel in San Diego and was one of was a significant donor to the Prop 8 effort, the 2008 ballot measure to ban same-sex marriage in California. I think Ross is right that there has been a copying of these tactics that are focused on pressuring elites and trying to rule out certain opinions in elite conversations, and that's a way to advance social goals. And I think that is a thing that was done in the gay marriage fight, but I also think it was done in conjunction with a whole bunch of other things that are not being replicated at the same time. That basically, whatever was happening with gay marriage, you were also having this enormous shift in popular opinion, not just in elite opinion. And part of why it was durable to ostracize the policy opposition to gay marriage was that the public was coming around on that quite forcefully. And so I'm wondering what you make of the copying of that tactic, and whether there are other parts of the suite of things that were done that were effective on gay marriage that aren't being copied at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, one essential part of the shifting of opinions on a whole range of gay rights issues, not just marriage, is coming out as a political mechanism. And, you know, one of the things that's unlike race or sex, often religion, people can control the terms under which they acknowledge, disclose, announce their sexual orientation or their gender identity for that matter. And I don't know whether this is a profound or banal point, but like, you know, gays and lesbians are almost by definition born to straight people. And there is a natural sort of distribution in the population of gays and lesbians into straight communities in a way that there is not African Americans being born to white parents, or you know, Jews being born to Catholic parents, or you know, immigrant children being born to native-born parents. And so, you know, social scientists call this contact theory. We've seen that the best predictor of liberal attitudes on gay rights is how somebody answers the question, do you know a friend, family member, or coworker who's openly gay or lesbian? And that has people coming out, and the sort of virtuous cycle of social acceptance, people coming out, creating more social acceptance is a huge part of that. And we have seen campaigns on the left now. You know, one of the breakthroughs on the marriage side was, in especially in the years approaching 2012, figuring out or looking for ways in which to sort of package that as a campaign tactic in advertising, starting to show gay or lesbian couples for the first time regularly in ads about gay marriage, trying to show that they want to marry for the same reasons that heterosexuals do. And then in campaign field programs, in door knocking, in phone calls, encouraging volunteers to open up really, you know, freewheeling and often uncomfortable conversations with strangers so that they can have a you know, to some degree, create a in a sort of artificial context the experience of actually knowing a gay or lesbian person and talking to them about why they want to marry. And we have seen efforts to try to take this and apply it to other, you know, especially lefty causes where, you know, so people are asking, are there ways that you can get, you know, voters to, through campaigns, feel like they know a victim of gun violence, or that they know an undocumented immigrant, or that they know a woman who's had an abortion. And it is harder to control those things to some degree because they are probably not naturally appearing in households and communities the same way that homosexuality has.
Sasha Eisenberg is Washington correspondent for Monocle magazine, a political reporter, and author of the new book, The Engagement, America's Quarter-Century Struggle Over Gay Marriage. Sasha, thanks for joining us. And I want to note for people, this book is a wonderfully detailed look at, because this wasn't just one big national fight. It was all of these individual fights in state houses and over referenda. And so it's really instructive to look at the cascade of successes and failures and the tactics. I think it's really useful if you're trying to understand how to do other kinds of social change movements. There's a lot of really granular detail in here. So I just want to say congratulations on the book.
I appreciate that, Josh.
I've been talking with Ross Douthat of the New York Times and Liz Bruning of the Atlantic. We will be back after this break to talk about communion. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider. On the right is Ross Douthat, columnist for the New York Times. And on the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has agreed to draft a document about whether Holy Communion should be withheld from Catholic politicians who take positions opposed to church teaching, particularly on abortion. The document doesn't exist yet, so we don't know exactly what it will say, nor do we know if the bishops will adopt it by the necessary two-thirds vote once the document has been drafted. And if it does come into force, it won't actually have that much force because Rome vests the decision about withholding communion in individual bishops, not in national church organizations. Still, the implications are important because our president is a church-going Catholic and a strong supporter of abortion rights. And this fight is in significant part about him and whether he should receive the Eucharist. Ross and Liz, you are, as many listeners know, both Catholic, as are about a quarter of Americans. I'm not Catholic. So before we talk about the merits of this not yet existing document, I'd like you to indulge our non-Catholic listeners. Can you give us an account of what the Eucharist is for theologically so that we can frame what it would mean to deny it to a parishioner?
So, the Eucharist is the reason that the church has to exist. So we have to have someone who can perform the sacraments. The sacraments are miracles. In particular, the Eucharist is the miraculous conversion of bread and wine into the body and blood of Jesus Christ himself, which delivered into the mouth of the recipient, the church-going, mass-going Christian, heals the spiritual body, the body of the person, right? Brings us closer into communion with Jesus Christ, gives us his grace, gives us the strength to go on, hopefully makes us stronger in Christ such that we go forth and sin less, prayerfully no more, and it aids in our salvation. Yes.
So yes, that's right. I endorse Liz's take. And basically, traditionally, Catholic teaching around the Eucharist was that because it is the body and blood of Jesus Christ, you should only be receiving it when you are in a condition disposed to receive it, which basically means having gone to confession recently and not be persisting in serious or mortal sin. And a lot of controversies around communion and Catholicism revolve around these issues, like the debate about whether divorced and remarried Catholics can receive communion, in part comes down to this question of what kind of state someone has to be in to receive communion. What's happened in the church in the last 50 or 60 years is you've had a sort of liberal versus conservative debate that parallels to some extent liberal and conservative debates in the secular world, where the liberal side tends to emphasize the idea that the Eucharist is a kind of spiritual medicine that is for the weak and therefore to strengthen them, and no one is weaker than a sinner, and so you should be really, really careful about ever withholding it from anybody, because the important thing is for people to receive. And the conservative side has taken, you know, the more stringent, you know, you're risking sacrilege, basically, if you receive communion when you're not in condition to do so. And so if you are a political figure who supports a set of policies that the church considers to be basically mass murder, which is the case with abortion, there's a decent argument that you're in a state not just of sin, but of a kind of public grave sin, where you're taking communion is both dangerous for you, it's dangerous for your soul to take it in that condition, and it's a kind of public scandal if the church is seen to be giving communion to people in that kind of position. And obviously a Democratic president who is a mass-going Catholic, who is in Biden's case, no longer even sort of conflicted and moderate supporter of abortion, but just a sort of straightforward supporter of abortion, creates a situation where, you know, it seems like you could withhold communion from him, and maybe you should.
And it should be said, the church historically has used the withholding of the sacraments not necessarily as a punishment. The idea is never, you know, that is what excommunication is. It's to tell a Catholic you cannot receive the sacraments for a period of time until you repent. The idea is never in excommunication to withhold the sacraments forever. It's not being shunned. It's not permanent. The idea is to encourage the individual to repent and return, to the sacraments. And they do it all the time. They've historically done it many, many, many times. Sometimes entire countries have been placed under interdict, which means entire countries have been banned from the sacraments until their leaders straighten out or whatever. This has gone on from time to time in history. And also this very kerfuffle over abortion and the sacraments has happened even with respect to Biden specifically before. And the bishops. I believe the last time it came up, John Paul II was Pope, and I believe Ted McCarrick intervened on Biden's behalf. So this is nothing new.
But so is this an appropriate thing for the church to be looking at doing right now? I mean, Liz, I realize you have historical examples there, but I mean, should the president receive communion? And more broadly, should the church be looking at the positions of American politicians and deciding that some of them are not in a position to receive communion?
Yeah, I mean, the church has done this for 2,000 years. America is a blip on its radar. I mean, for me, I'm shocked that they let me receive communion, so I sort of have no place to say whether or not they have any business ruling on anybody else.
Well, I don't think that's right. I mean, you take communion, right? So you certainly have a position on whether you ought to receive communion.
I do sometimes, if I'm in a position to, if I've gone to confession and so forth, and I've got my ducks in a row, but I don't always. Like I said, I'm always sort of concerned that I maybe shouldn't be, but I need it.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely received communion when I should not have.
Yeah, same.
And it's yeah. I think the issue here is the church absolutely has the right to pass judgment on the question of whether one of the most important Catholic politicians in the world should be receiving communion. That's literally what the church is for. The problem for the church is that it is weak, divided, scandal-ridden, and for reasons that you laid out at the start of this, Josh, there's no way to actually effectuate this because Biden's own bishops are unlikely to personally deny him communion. And so any sort of intervention by the body of bishops would be a political and not a pastoral intervention. And if you judge it politically, I think it looks like it will look like a partisan intervention rather than a religious intervention. And the church has a problem right now where it's closely associated with a Republican Party that is unchristian and un-Catholic in various ways. And so those are all good prudential reasons not to do this, since it won't happen. But it's a sign of the church's weakness that it's in the position where it just has to think of itself as like a political actor doing symbolic actions that don't have any force. In a world where the church were stronger, presumably, yeah, you would have many more politicians being denied communion from time to time, as we all should be.
There's another piece of context here, which is, I think about a year or so ago, Pew put out a poll that only about a third of Catholics in the United States even believe in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, which means, you know, a few hundred years ago, two-thirds of American Catholics would be considered Protestant. They would be heretics. So what are we even doing anymore? Only a third of American Catholics even believe in such a way that this would even matter. And Wilton Gregory, who is the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., has already said he's going to allow Biden to receive communion. So this is going to be ineffectual, however it turns out. So this is sort of a sad comedy.
Well, but the other thing is, and maybe this is part of what you mean, Ross, when you say that the church is weak, but my sense is that not just with big prominent politicians, but also with ordinary parishioners, that the Catholic Church is just a lot softer on this stuff than it used to be. I mean, people go to confession much less than they did a few decades ago, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you don't see the church imposing these sorts of sanctions a lot on ordinary people, if you then do it to the president, it starts to look, I think, as you're describing, like an overtly political act, and that if the church wants to crack down on this sort of thing, it would have to do that from top to bottom. And then as Liz notes, it's not just the Eucharist. I think you'd find a lot of Catholics who just sort of don't take this seriously enough that they would be willing to put up with that.
Right. Although, I mean, and I think in the defense of the bishops, again, we don't actually have this document. I think that many of the bishops voting for this document think that they're voting for a document on the proper reception of the Eucharist that could be part of some attempt to generally reconnect Catholics with the idea that you should take this more seriously, that it's not just something you have a right to, that you should be going to confession more often and so on. It's just that if you start talking like that, people are going to say, well, how does this apply to the most prominent Catholic in the United States, right? I mean, it's sort of hard. It's a trap from which it's very difficult to escape, I think, without just not talking about this entirely, which is also tough to do since it is actually important to Catholicism.
Right. And then the top line of comedy on all of this is that you have a sort of church which has become sort of diffuse and weak and riddled by scandal that has stripped it of almost all of its moral credibility with the broader world and with its own constituency. And then you have faithful, which has shrunk and which does not attend Mass nearly as often as it used to, and which has vastly decreased in faithfulness anyway. And then you have a country which has never been particularly Catholic, which has only its second Catholic president ever, who does not particularly adhere to the beliefs of the church, as evinced by this whole hullabaloo. And now you're going to have this ineffectual, potentially, decision by the church. And on top of all that, you have a press, which is broadly secular, getting pissed off about the Eucharist.
Well, there are a lot of semi-lapsed Catholics in our profession. I think it's fair to say, who have a sort of proprietary attitude to the church they've left behind. So, Josh, have we convinced you to convert?
Oh,
I mean, that's what this is all about,
right?
This
is like the opposite of a compelling sales pitch, right here.
No, but see, this is Chris. This is always our.
You are
sales
making
pitch,
your
though.
Church sound pathetic.
You know, it's awful.
Oh,
it's pathetic.
Is.
It's terrible. It's also the truth. So come on in.
We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
Summer is a time of food that's very inefficient to eat. It's really obnoxious. Crab legs, for instance. Why am I spending so much time dealing with sharp bone-like structures to get 1 ounce of food that's not very good? Same story with crab in general. Why am I using a little hammer to get through a bunch of pointy sharp stuff to food that just tastes like seawater and avoiding a bunch of really gross stuff to get there? Corn on the cob, another huge offender. Just cut it off of there. I want to eat it with a fork. Why am I doing this with my teeth and getting my hands dirty? People, just take the meat out of the shell, off the bone, take the vegetables off of whatever horrible fibrous little stalk it's on. I don't know why I'm going through all of this trouble to get a very small amount of food when it's easier just to use tools like God intended.
Russ Douthat, it's your soapbox.
I can't top that. I have a boring complaint, which is that I enjoyed the New York mayoral race, which is, I guess, still continuing in some sense for a little while. I think its outcome vindicated a lot of my own right of center priors, since it so far appears to be a defeat for the once ascendant defund the police left. But really, it's ridiculous how much attention the national media pays to the New York mayoral race. And it's just a signifier of how completely and utterly concentrated in the Acela corridor in New York and DC the national media is. And, you know, I could go my whole life without reading another story about politics in the five boroughs and be content. And I won't, but I wish I could.
For my rant, Las Vegas Raiders defensive end Carl Nassib came out of the closet this week. He's in the middle of a 3-year, $25 million contract, and he's gay. He's the first out gay man on an active NFL roster. And this is great. Pro sports is one of the last bastions of the closet, and the only people who can change that are gay athletes like Nassib. It's great that he came out, and more should follow him so that gay aspiring players know that sports are for them too. What Nassib did is hard, and I don't want to downplay that. But ordinary people do the hard work of coming out of the closet every day, very often with more danger and less resources available to them. And the reason I say that is that I worry when people talk about how brave it is to come out of the closet, it makes it sound like something only an extraordinary person can do, that you need particularly great strength to be able to handle that. And you do need to be strong, but it's within most people. And I think it's important for people to know that, especially for other gay players in the NFL to know they can do this too. You can come out. So many people have come out before you. And when you do, I think you very infrequently hear somebody say that they regret coming out of the closet. I think it is a relief for a lot of these people. So I'm really thrilled about what Nassib did. And I really hope he's followed by more people so that we can show that gays are everywhere, including the NFL. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Ross Douthat, Liz Brunig, and Sasha Eisenberg. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. This show is recorded and mixed by John Meek, and Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more of Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.